When I was a youngster, we lived on a farm, and we had a nice creek and a woods nearby, and there was trees and so forth along that creek. And I spent a lot of my time growing up playing around in the creek and along the creek and building forts and having a wonderful time. I don't think that happens as much today as it did back when I was a young kid. But I tell you what, Richard Louv has talked about that in his book. His book is called Last Child in the Woods. It's published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And many of you have called and asked me or written to me and asked me to have Richard on the program. And we're fortunate to get him on today to talk about saving our children from nature deficit disorder. Again, his book is titled Last Child in the Woods, and we welcome him by phone. Richard Louv, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I enjoyed your book very much. I have a daughter who's going to be 4 years old on September 1st, and this whole business of giving her a nature experience is something very important to me. But let's back up and talk a bit about how things have changed from when you and I were kids.
Well, your description of your experience when you were a kid was very much like mine. I grew up outside of Kansas City on the edge of the suburbs, and I could go out my back door and into the field and beyond that into the woods that seemed to go on forever. I could not have told you anything about acid rain or global warming, of course, as a kid, but I had an intimate relationship with those woods. They were my woods. I owned them in my heart. In fact, I pulled out, I think, hundreds of survey stakes as an eight-year-old because I knew they had something to do with the bulldozers. There was a sense of ownership, a sense of connection that went very deep, and those woods were in my heart then, and they're in my heart today, and I sometimes go to them, even though they were torn down long ago. They're a source of strength, a source of wonder, even today. So the real question is, will children in the future have that place to go to in their heart?
Well, and you talk about frontiers, the various frontiers that we sort of have had here in the United States. And I guess as you were kind of pointing out here, kids today, I think, or children are frankly probably more aware of global threats, warming and that sort of thing, than they are with what's going on in their neighborhood.
I think that's true. We know a lot of endangered species, but we don't know the species in our own backyard, or children tend not to. And in fact, you know, your prior conversation about invasive species suggests the conversation about endangered species, of course. And to my mind, it raises a question. I was recently in Ukiah, California, which is up in the mountains of Northern California. It's one of those towns, Spotted Owl Central. You know, it's one of those places with a great controversy about the spotted owl. It's a beautiful place, huge woods, wonderful, you know, mist down in the trees, et cetera. And the educators there told me what teachers and parents tell me all over the country, which is that kids aren't going out there either, even though the woods are right there. The question that this raises is the spotted owl the leading indicator species, the leading endangered indicator species, or is it something else? I think it's the human child in nature, because if children are not going out and bonding with nature now, who in the world will care about the spotted owl in 10 or 15 years?
Good point. And kids just aren't. I mean, across the country, I think perhaps parts of Wisconsin, I'm thinking about Wisconsin now, parts of Wisconsin, I think kids are, or children are, get a pretty good dose of the out of doors. To some extent, we're a rural state. And so I think any kids that are born on a farm, for example, or raised on a farm are going to get that kind of experience. But the reality is that even in this state of, 5 million people or so, probably 4.5 million of them are, I may be exaggerating here, are raised in urban environments.
And there are actually very few family farms left. So many of the people who live in those so-called rural areas are working at the 7-Eleven. They're not out on the farm in the field. Let me back up for a second. 1893, the famous essay was written in speech given by Frederick Jackson Turner, who declared that the American frontier was over. He based that on the 1890 census. Exactly 100 years later, in 1993, the U.S. Census Bureau issued what it said would be the last farm family report that it would issue. That was based on the 1990 census. The reason being that there weren't enough family farms left to really count. Now, Wisconsin has more proportionately family farms left than most other states. But still, what does that indicate? I think that that is a demarcation line in our history that is actually more important than when Frederick Jackson Turner declared that the American frontier was over, because that childhood experience in nature, in the formative years, baby boomers are the last generation, really, to have some kind of familial contact with agriculture when they were growing up, an aunt, an uncle, a grandfather owned a farm to which we would go and visit. That ended with, pretty much in American society with the baby boomers. What comes after that?
Yeah. You talk in your book, and I really enjoyed your book, by the way. I read it with great interest. Our society, in a lot of ways, teaches people to avoid direct experience in nature, does it not?
Well, it does. One of the easy things to do with this issue is to blame it on video games. Obviously, video games and television are very seductive, and they compete for time. But stopping there, I think, would be a mistake. I think there are a number of other factors. One of the factors that is most important is fear, parental fear. Parents are scared to death of stranger danger, and increasingly kids are raised under essentially protective house arrest because the parents are so scared of what might be out there. The truth is, when you look at the statistics on stranger danger, there's very little stranger crime against children. The vast, vast majority of abductions, for instance, of children are done by parents or family, other family members and people the family knows, not strangers. The reason for this growth in fear has less to do with reality than it does with our profession. All you have to do is watch CNN or Fox, and you'll see how they take a handful of terrible crimes against children there, repeat them over and over again until we believe that there's a child snatcher on every street corner. That's the very definition of conditioning, and I hold my own profession accountable for that.
Now, well, there are other things that mitigate against youngsters being outside. You talk about treehouses as an example, I guess.
Yeah, there's a chapter early in Last Child in the Woods called The Criminalization of Natural Play. If you start counting up all the rules and regulations from the federal to the state, and then you add to those the huge increase in covenants and restrictions, these are the private rules that are enforced by community associations, for instance, in almost every housing development, certainly the planned ones built in the last 30 years, almost every new housing development built during that period, in the fine print you'll find all kinds of things you can't do. These are the kind of things, you know, I had a woman come up to me early on who said that her community association had recently outlawed chalk drawing on the sidewalk. I mean, sometimes these rules are pretty ridiculous. But just try to put up a basketball hoop in some of these communities, let alone let the kids build a house or a tree house or a fort. It's not going to happen. So the very message that's being sent increasingly in the new developments is that playing outdoors is probably illicit and possibly illegal. And the fear of lawsuit is very intense among parents also. So, you know, the thought of putting up a treehouse in the backyard and inviting the kids over from the the neighborhood. If people stop to think about that, given the litigious society, they will think twice.
I just saw in the paper, maybe it was this morning or yesterday, a Wisconsin town where somebody, a guy had built a treehouse and had spent quite a bit of money on it. And the town was told him he had to take it down or he was going to be fined so much a day. And was busily writing a new ordinance because there hadn't been an ordinance about treehouses. So,
that's happening all over the country. It's just an amazing thing, this sense of need for control, which I think is related to our fear as a society that we're living in a state of fear. An interesting idea came up the other day on a blog by a lawyer that was sent to me. He suggests that we have a Leave No Child Inside Legal Defense Fund, where lawyers would contribute to this legal defense fund, and other people could too, but lawyers would work pro bono to come to the aid of families that want to have that treehouse or have that experience for their kid in nature. I think it's a very interesting idea.
Richard Louvre, our guest today, author of Last Child in the Woods. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking with Richard Louvre now today, the author of several books, including the one we're discussing today called Last Child in the Woods, published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. And in it, he talks about the divide between young people and the natural world and the implications of that divide for the kids and for all of us, as a matter of fact. And he uses, cites a lot of research, I should say, that reveals the necessity of contact with nature for healthy child and adult development. And it's not a book that's all gloom and doom, I should mention. He also offers many suggestions and solutions, things that you and I, all of us, can do to sort of mitigate against this and try and turn it around a bit. So we're pleased to have him along. And certainly if you want to join in, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. Richard, what really happens when young people spend less and less of their lives in natural surroundings?
Well, first let me make clear, kids that are raised without experience in the natural world can turn out just fine. That's clear. It's more about what they're denied, what they miss out on. And the studies that have emerged really only in the last dozen years, because I might add that this subject has been, I think, tragically under-researched, the impact of the natural world on child development. But within the last dozen years, there's been a lot of very interesting studies. University of Illinois studies of kids with the symptoms of attention deficit disorder, the symptoms get much better with just a little bit of contact with the natural world, even kids as young as 5 years old. Studies of stress show great stress reduction for kids and adults just by going out in nature. Other studies of cognitive development, schools that have some kind of outdoor classroom, the kids learn better in those schools. They get higher test grades when they learn more outside than the typical school, which basically has the kids sitting in cubicles all year. Creativity, kids playing on asphalt or turf flat playgrounds compared to the kids who play in natural play areas. The kids who play in natural play areas are far more likely to invent their own games. They play more cooperatively. The leaders who emerge tend to be the smartest kids, as opposed to the flat asphalt or turf playground, where the kids who emerge as leaders tend to be the physically strongest. There's a lot more research that I'm just skimming the surface here, but it's very interesting the impact that nature has in a very positive way on child development.
Yeah. I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. Rodney in Pierce County, we'll go to you first. Rodney, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. I'd like to share a part of my life that I tend to share with people. I was raised in Florida, and at 9 and 10 years old, I lived the life of that program of Flipper. I had my own boat, and I was out in Key Biscayne after school every day. I watched a program with the DNR concerning Dade County, and they were arresting 14-year-olds for being out in the bay without being 16 years old. I dealt with dolphins out in that bay, sharks at 9 and 10 years old, and I felt it was the greatest adventure. One more point, I have a relative that lives in Puget Sound, and their family has been out in Puget Sound when they were young children. Even some of the girls had rowboats out in Puget, and the same thing, the criminalization of the DNR in these states to make it a criminal offense for a child to be out on the water under 16 years old, we just don't get it, and maybe that's what the writer is talking about.
Thanks for calling, Rodney. Richard, a comment?
Well, I don't know specifically about the DNR, but I can't imagine growing up without being out in my boat when I was 11, 12. You know, the thought of that being a criminal act is an interesting thought. I think that this really permeates the society now in terms of we spend far more time telling people what they can't do than what they can do. I am hopeful that this is turning around. I mentioned one idea earlier about the attorney who thinks that we need to leave no child inside legal defense fund. But many of the government agencies now are starting to do things since the book came out. The U.S. Forest Service, I was back in D.C. a few weeks ago helping announce the More Kids in the Woods program by the National Forest Service to fund programs to get kids out, including inner cities. The U.S. Department of Interior, the Secretary of Interior, has taken a deep interest in this issue and is doing what he can. There's a lot going on out there that I think that can turn this around or at least make it better.
Yeah. Vince in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, Vince.
Hi. I read the book, Last Child in the Woods, and liked it very much. I'm a baby boomer, and I grew up in a ravine, and spent summers on my grandfather's farm. And our children are raised in a rural area here and benefited tremendously from it, and not just playing in nature, but also working in nature, helping cut wood and garden and milk the goats and, but now I've got young grandchildren, I bring them out, but frankly, they hang around the yard, but I'm kind of afraid to take them out in the woods and tramp around. We're in the center of this Lyme disease problem, and I myself just am recovering from it, a very serious bout of it, and it turns out that these little deer ticks, again, is not just a temporary hazard. This can be a lifelong problem if you get it in your system, and it's a very serious disease. And so there's some fear there that I think is maybe realistic. And I wonder how our author, I don't know if you were aware of the Lyme disease problem, but it's a serious one in our area, at least.
Okay. Richard?
Well, I am familiar with that, and the caller is right. I mean, I'm not saying that there is not risk out there in many forms. There are strangers out there, even though the numbers are not high, there are strangers out there. I think what we need to do, though, is begin to think in terms of comparative risk. While there is risk outside our houses for kids, there's risk in raising a generation under protective house arrest. Most notably, child obesity, the rise in child obesity. If we want to talk about a huge risk to kids, pediatricians are now saying that this may be the first generation of Americans to die at an earlier age than their parents since World War II because of child obesity. That comes from a sedentary lifestyle.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks, Vince, for calling. Rich in Burlington will give you a chance now. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Just a comment regarding your last call. The risks of living inside in a, in quote, so-called controlled environment with all of the possibilities of things in the air that we're recirculating with our air conditioning on is another risk that people seem to ignore. But my comment was it's not just young people that are not being out in nature and natural areas. They're just not taking independent activities on themselves. We're organizing and structuring everything for them. I teach environmental science at the high school, and I've taken my students out a lot just to get them out of doors for obvious reasons, but I've also coached a lot of Park District teams with young people and asking the kids if, you know, we're playing baseball. Are you guys practicing? Do you play baseball? Well, no, only when we come to practice. Well, get outside and play baseball with your friends. There's no one there to organize it.
Yeah.
And they're so used to everything being organized for them that they just don't get out and figure it out.
Yeah.
And it's not just in natural areas. It's in a lot of areas.
Yeah. Thanks, Rich. Richard, a comment?
Well, that certainly is one of the themes of the book. And I've heard that same thing all over the country, the concern by teachers and parents that, that unless something is organized and then under surveillance by adults, then it doesn't happen. That's one of the reasons why these studies of how kids play in natural areas versus the flat playgrounds are interesting, because there is something about being out in nature. A group of kids just naturally start making up their own games. They make things with the things that are available. So I think that taking kids outdoors, as the teacher who just called, I think that that can be an antidote to some of that overregulation and over control that this generation is growing up with.
Yeah. Rich, thanks. Appreciate it very much. Lori and Nina, it's your turn. Hi, Lori.
Yeah, hi. I started reading your book. It's a summer read for me, and I also teach hunter's education here in Nina. And, you know, just a little bit I got into it, I'm really, when my daughter grew up, we used to go up north, and we used to do all this stuff. And, you know, I understand the wood tick business. We still are having that problem with, you know, when we go up there. But one comment drew me when you said about the tree houses. You know, I grew up in Kaukauna here, in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, just, you know, a little bit north of here. And we used to have tree houses and different things that we'd have, because it grew up like alongside the Fox River. And the railroad used to come down, instead of even saying anything to us, they'd cut the whole tree down. Instead of saying, hey, I have this fun tree house up here. And, of course, this was in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, they didn't even consider our feelings toward this. But, yeah, I can understand where you're coming from when it comes to, I love your book so far that I've gotten into it. And being that I teach hunters education, I think I'm going to learn a lot more once I get it finished. So that's just my comment.
Thanks, Lori. Comment, Richard?
Well, you know, there's a court case in England that was very interesting that talked about a boy who got through a fence that had been put around a public lake, and the signs keeping people out of that lake, which had been open for decades, had not been put up yet, and he got into the lake and almost drowned. The magistrate threw the case out. It was a lawsuit, threw the case out, and said that we had to think in terms of comparative risk. Yes, there is risk of kids drowning, but there's a greater risk of kids never learning how to swim.
Yeah.
And he weighed that risk, which does exist, against the decades to come of families that would get outside and get exercise and have a healthy life because of that lake. I think we need to think more in those terms. He had a great line in his summation, the magistrate did, which he says, if a child falls out of a tree and is hurt, does that mean that we cut down the entire forest?
Yeah. Lori, thank you. Stephen Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, gentlemen. Just an observation and a question. In my children's school in the city of Oshkosh, I've noted that sometimes the only bikes in the bike rack are my son and my daughter, that among 212 students, literally, day after day in May, in nice weather, there are no bikes, and how that's changed in generation. And the question is, wouldn't it be wise, I think, to have every high school student, to have a requirement that students can ride a 20-mile course or complete 20 miles in, say, 4 hours, so that people think of not burning fossil fuels at every turn, at every point in life?
I think that is a good idea. The 20 miles for a lot of these kids sounds like a long way. But I think that kind of thinking is important. And the truth is that many schools now are taking out the bike racks. They're telling parents that the kids should not ride bikes to school because of fear of getting hit by cars and all of that. In many ways, the schools, while handing out brochures to the parents about child obesity, those same schools, as in Broward County, Florida, are putting up no running signs now on many of the playgrounds. This is true. You know, what are we thinking? We in many ways, are going in the exact opposite direction than we say we should go, which is more physical activity, less sedentary lifestyle.
Thanks, Steve. Dick in Waukesha, your turn. Hi, Dick.
Well, I guess this is a little bit more of the same. I'm a tad older than most of the callers, probably. I'm 85, so I grew up in the 20s and the 30s. But we lived on a dead-end street and had one vacant lot. There are houses on all the others, and only 100 yards long. And we called that the Little Woods, and we played in there until we were maybe six, seven. And then we started to venture farther afield. To the next block, there was a vacant lot with just weeds and grass. There was a house to the north, and there was a house. There was a vacant lot to the east, but then a house. And I don't remember how we decided to set that thing on fire, but we did. And not thinking about the consequences, just thinking about how much fun it would be to see it burn. Of course, somebody in the house to the north, I suppose, somewhere called the police. And I remember there was a hedge that I couldn't get through to the east and a fence on the north. And I almost got caught in the corner, but I managed to tear to the west along that north fence with the flames licking at me. And when I got out, there were five or six of us. I think we only had one policeman, Chief Coombs, got rolled up. He said, "Come here, guys." You know, and he was very gentle, you know, and explained what a hazardous thing that was we had done. And, you know, he didn't yell at us, and he didn't arrest us and throw us in the clink. But I never forgot that.
And that's about 70 years ago or more, 75 years ago. And I guess one of the things that's kind of struck me as Dick was talking, and this is something you comment on in your book, those places that we grew up as kids, when we had the chance to be in the outdoors or in nature, we remember those. I vividly remember all of the places that I went to as a young child along the creek and in the woods.
Well, and it's an important point that your caller made. Setting aside the issue of setting things on fire, this is an important point. And the people who study this call this nearby nature. I'm not suggesting that we all have to take our kids to Yosemite or to the Upper Peninsula. You know, it is really where we live, even in the most urban areas. By nearby nature, I mean that clump of trees at the end of the cul-de-sac or that ravine behind the house. Those of us who grew up with those small little pieces of what we considered wildness still treasure those places. And to adults, they may not look important at all, but to a child, they can be the whole universe. And those places are important, too.
Well, what do we as parents and grandparents, what our neighbors, how do we combat this? What do we do? What positive steps do we take?
Well, I'm now the chairman of something called the Children in Nature Network, and people can learn about that by going to cnaturenet.org.
C as in the letter C?
Yes, naturenet.org. Or they can find it by going to leavenochildinside.org or .com. And the purpose of this is to encourage this movement that really seems to have emerged in the last year and a half, where urban regions around the country are starting to not just say this is only up to parents, because parents really can't do it alone, many of them. We have to remember there's a new generation of young parents coming up that many of them had no experience in nature. And even when they learn about the great positive health benefits of nature to their kids and want that for their kids, they don't know where to start. So in addition to parents and grandparents and others taking kids out into nature themselves, because it's not going to happen accidentally now because of that state of fear we're in. In addition to that, it's important that we support the institutions and organizations that help parents do that. And those are the nature centers, you know, your caller earlier, the environmental educator who takes kids outdoors, the scouting organizations, and so forth. We need to support those institutions and organizations, both morally and financially, because it's not going to happen accidentally.
Time for another call. Judy in St. Clair, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have just 2 points. One is that I'm a member of the Superior Hiking Trail Association, and I urge everybody to get their kids out on the hiking trails. And number two, I had to chuckle when I heard the comment about the judge saying, what do you do, cut down the whole forest, you know, so the kid doesn't fall out of the tree. Well, you can imagine my dismay when I returned to my beautiful elementary school when I was a little kid, which was surrounded by an oak grove in which we used to play, and every tree but three was cut down. I was just sick to my stomach. I went to the principal's office, and I was probably fourth or fifth grade, and I said, why did this happen? And the principal explained insurance to me. So that was the first I heard about
liability. Liability. Yeah. Richard, comment?
Well, once again, that issue comes up. I think that the liability is a very important issue. We've got to get lawyers involved in trying to think this through. But also the connection to conservation. The Sierra Club does a good job of getting kids out. Most recently, the head of the National Youth Programs for the Sierra Club is on the board of the Children and Nature Network, and I have a lot of respect for what he's doing. I was recently in Wisconsin just a few weeks ago, where I was invited by the Aldo Leopold Foundation to participate in a discussion with 10 other people about how to apply the Leopold land ethic to the 21st century. And for those listeners who may not know who Aldo Leopold was, in the 1940s, he wrote a book called Sand County Almanac. And it, along with Silent Spring, by Rachel Carson, was one of the two pivotal books of the 20th century in shaping conservation. His daughters and son were there, Estella and Nina and Carl, who are now, I believe, in their late 70s, early 80s. Wonderful people. And the discussion seemed to center around this question of, will future generations have the chance to have that kind of experience in nature? And that itself is a hugely important conservation issue.
And with that, we have to close, Richard. I thank you very much for being with us today, and I'm highly recommending your book, Last Child in the Woods. Go to cnature.org. I just did that myself. Cnaturenet, I'm sorry, .org, and you'll find out some more about the book. You can get it from your local bookstore, I'm certain. Thank you again, Richard. I appreciate you being with us very much. Very, very much appreciate it. Richard Louv, author of Last Child in the Woods. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.